go from wearing tefillin and from all those affirmative commandments which the Torah commands us to observe. All right, this is the first statement in the Mishnah. Now, the next statement tells us that this law of being excused from reciting Krishna applies also to those who are then actively engaged in the burial process. Nosei hamita, those who are carrying the funeral bier, in other words, they're carrying the bier upon which the body lies, the chidufeihen, and those who take their place, the chidufeihen, and those who take the place of those who have already relieved the others, because don't forget, they weren't taking them in a hearse, they were taking them on their shoulders in order to take them to the cemetery for burial. And so therefore they needed people to actually carry the bier with the dead body.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you switch, so those who are carrying them and those who are after them and those who replace them and so on. So the Mishnah says that there is a difference in the law concerning those who are in front of the bier. In other words, those who still either are carrying in front or who still have to carry the bier, okay, because they are in front of the bier, as compared to those who are behind the bier. And particularly we're talking now about those who have already carried it for a certain distance and they're finished with it. All right, so those who are in front of the bier, and you know the bier still requires their physical participation, so therefore they are excused. The yesha alachar hamita tzorach b'hem, and those who are behind the mita, who and the bier needed their help, so chayovim, they have to recite. They are obligated to recite. Now, what are they obligated to recite? Well, we'll take a look at the Rashi for a moment. All right. Anyway, the Mishnah now continues and it says, "Ve'elu peturim minat tefila." However, whether they are in front or behind, what they are excused from is from staying Shemini Esrei. In other words, the implication is what?
But they can't stand still to say Shemini Esrei. They have to continue to walk with the.
Does Krishna require standing still for more than a moment? This we learned. No.
No.
I mean, for the first paragraph, you stay still.
You can
still.
Say it either sitting
right.
or standing.
Right. Or if you're walking.
You can say
you stop for a moment in order to concentrate, and then after that you can go on and continue on your way, okay? So that this is what we learned then, that those who are already finished with the job, they are still excused from saying Shemini Esrei. Presumably what? Presumably they didn't have time yet to get back to their home or to get back to the shul or whatever it may be, okay? So if they didn't have the time, then in that case they're excused from the Shemini Esrei. However, they should recite Krishna, as we said, because it doesn't require the same amount of time to concentrate upon Krishna as it does upon Shemini Esrei. But there's another reason too. The other reason being that in one case, one is a from Midoraiso, from the Torah, and the other one is with the Rabbana. So, since the burial of the dead is also Mitzvah Midoraiso, Torah commands us we have to bury our dead, okay? So that therefore, if you are engaged in one Mitzvah, you are potter from another Mitzvah which would interfere with this. And the question is, of course, which Mitzvah has the primacy in this particular case? The burial of the dead is the primary mitzvah at this particular point. Until the dead has been buried, then that takes priority over everything else. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, kovru es hameis, the burial has now been has taken place. They have now completed the burial. The chazru, and now they return back from the cemetery. So im yicholim lahaskil v'digmerat shelo yagir l'shura, if they are able to begin, meaning, you know, to begin the recital of Krishna, let's say, and to finish it by the time that they get to the Shura, and the Shura means these are the rows of Menachamim, people who are there in order to express their condolences to the bereaved, right? Of course, today we still do it at the cemetery, but in those days, presumably, people would make a row, let's say, as the Avelim passed through until they could get into their own home and begin sitting Shiva over there. So, if there is time for them to complete the recital of the Krishna, by the time that they reach the place where the Shura is taking place, where they're going to have to stand in line in order to greet the bereaved, then yaskil, they can be the imbav. However, if there isn't time enough, then lo yaskil, they shouldn't. All right, now what about the people who are standing in the shura itself? Even here, the Mishnah makes a distinction. Omdim ba shura, when people are standing in the rows in order to, to comfort, to console, right, the bereaved, then hapnimiyim peturim, machitzonim chayovim. Those who are in the inner rows are required, are excused from saying, Krishna, whereas those who are on the outer rows, then they do have the obligation. Obviously, why? Because they're already on the fringes. If they're on the fringes, then in that particular case, there's no reason why they should not recite the Krishna. Okay, now the next statement, as I said, we would leave that because this, strictly speaking, is not, doesn't belong over here. It's really the Mishnah, the next Mishnah that will be discussed. So when we get to it, we'll get to it. Okay?
Can I ask you
yes.
a question? Suppose that you are able to bury your dead and still have time to say Krishna. At that particular point, you should say Krishna.
Yeah, there's no question about that.
In other words,
right. If the burial took place, let's say, very early in the
morning.
Okay? All right. And you get back to the house, then there's no question. I mean, once you're back in the house, you're obligated to recite Krishna. The one thing that I said, the first day, you don't put on tefillin, if it's the first day. Because that is a special rule of mourning, okay? Based upon the incident that I told you about in the prophet Ezekiel, where God said to him that Pe'ercho Chavosh, you must put on the diadem, the crown of glory, which of course is the tefillin shel rosh, you see. So from this we learn that an ordinary mourner
should not,
Yecheskel, does not put it on, and that applies to the first day. But davening on the first day, once the burials take place, there's no question. Benching on the first day, yes, definitely, just as benching on the others. But when is a person excused from it? It's while the burial still has not yet taken place, and he has not yet had an opportunity, to get home. But even if he has an opportunity to get home, I pointed out last week, what happens in the case, let's say a burial takes place, it's late in the afternoon. And of course, New York, that's very often.
Sure.
Here occasionally, but in New York it happens very often. And you know that you'll never have time to get back to your house in order to begin sitting Shiva.
For that day.
Yeah, before the sun sets. Okay? Now, the law is that concerning the first day and concerning the seventh day of Shiva, we have a ruling which says, Miksas Hayom Kehula Yom. That if you are able to observe even part of the day, it's as if you observed a complete day. Okay? So, in that particular case, the ruling then says that as far as the first day is concerned, okay, you want to get credit for a full day, which you would not get if you had no opportunity whatever to observe any avelis on that day. Then you'd have to, that day is going down the drain, so to speak, and you first begin counting the following day. But if you can observe something of mourning on that first day, then you can get credit for the complete day. All right, so what do you do? So what you do is you take off your shoes. You sit down on the ground for a few moments, you take your shoes off, so that way you are observing at least one of the rules of mourning. You are displaying one of the rules of mourning. So that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Erev Shabbos, you have another problem. Normally, for example, the first meal when you come home should be a meal that others bring to you. This is what we call the Seudas Habra, which means the meal of consolation. That others prepare the food and they bring it, and you sit down, the Ovil sits down and
he
is served. Right. But what if it's Erev Shabbos and there isn't time?
Problem.
you have a problem. But the answer is Erev Shabbos in that case is
Shabbos
more
takes
important
over.
It takes over. So you don't, but observe something.
But you don't. Sit, you don't. Obviously, you don't. Yeah. You don't sit during Shabbos. Shabbos is.
No. All right. That brings us to another area, of course, and that is what is the difference between Shabbos and the ordinary days in the week. Okay. So we'll see. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. Okay. All right. Let's take a look for a moment at the Rashi. All right. Mishum Eso. He says, "Spotim in the Kriyas." You know, "Spotim in the Cross Kriyas." Person who's dead is still there, mutar lefano, in other words, still lies unburied, then he is excused from saying Krishna, lefishu torah b'machsheves kruaso. Why? So Rashi explains very simply, because he is concerned in his thoughts about how to proceed, you know, with the burial, taking care of the burial. The heavy adumi the chos and the potamishum kirtan the mitzvah. And this case then is parallel to that we learned in the previous chapter about a chosin who is also so occupied with the mitzvah of the first night that he is also excused from Krishna. Of course, we learned at the end of the second chapter last week that according to Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, not everybody should consider himself such a great Talmud Chacham that he has only the thoughts of heaven upon his mind. It's already presuming a little too much, and therefore all Hasanim today do recite Krishna on the wedding night. Okay, but according to the Mishnahs, we learned the Mishnah says that they are part of, again, why? As we said, Tirdon Mitzvah, because they are concerned about how well they can proceed with the performance of the mitzvah, which has priority at this time. All right, now then, of course, those who carry, and then it says, what is Vechilut again? So he says, Shekhen Derek Shem is Chalfin Lotzeis, the Bishakol Chafesim is Kolzbo. This is interesting. What Rashi is saying over here is that people take turns in carrying the bier. We might think, you know, if I would ask you superficially right now, why do people take turns? I'm sure you would think along the lines that I'm thinking, namely that it is because you get tired of carrying a burden and you need somebody else to take over the burden.
I think it's out of respect to the...
This is what Rashi says. What Rashi says is that people want to take turns in doing it because they want, you know, they all want to have the schus, they all want to have the merit of carrying the dead body to the burial. That's the reason why. Reminds you to a certain extent these pictures, you know, that you see sometimes of the... like when Chomedy passed away, and you know the casket,
they all want to touch
strong,
the casket,
right, and they all want to do something like that. Well, because it's an old custom. Obviously, this was the custom, and you know, even for example, if a great goyim like Reb Moshe Feinstein passes away, people do want to be at the burial, even if they can't get anywhere near over there, so that they should have the schus of taking part in the burial of such a great. Okay, so Eshel if they hamito, those who are still in front of the bier, sheyizasku bo kasher tagi hamita etzlom, right? Those are the ones who are standing there and they're waiting for their turn to take care of the mito of the bier when it is passed to them. Vishela acha hamito. And those who are behind it, Shenisau Kivar, Rashi explains, those are the people who already have had their turn at carrying it. So, Shalif Neyamita Sarah Behem Peturim. Kim Sechum says to Peturim. Rashi says, if they are still in front and they are necessary to carry them, in that case, they're part of the same Krishna. Vishala Acha Amito, and those who are behind, Atim Sarah Behem. This is what is new that Rashi has, he says. Even if they are still needed in order to carry the bier, if they've already had their turn, so he says, Chayovim, they still are obligated to recite Krishna. Why? Why? Because by carrying it, they have already fulfilled the mitzvah. So even though they still have to continue to carry, but they could get some other people, you see, to help carry those who have already finished, and therefore their primary obligation is no longer there, and therefore they shall recite Krishna. All right, the eilu ve'eilu, and it makes no difference whether in front or in the rear, right? Peturim min atpila. They are excused from saying Shmonesra. Why? The lav deraisa hi. Shmonesra is not a commandment of the Torah. It's instead a rabbinic enactment, right? Rabbi Seinu Pershu, lefishi yesh lahem od shehus. And now Rashi says, now our rabbi explained another reason. They said, you know, that why are they excused? Why are they excused from saying Shmonesra at this particular point if they're still, even though they're behind the beer? You understand? So he says, it's because Yesh Lahem Od Shehus. They still have time to catch up on it. Apparently, time at this particular point is not a factor. But Vali Nireh Shein Zeh Loshem Patur. Now, Rashi is criticizing the explanation of our rabbis because he says, to me, it doesn't sound that this is the language of Potter. But of course, the question is, what does Potter mean? And for this, we'll take a look at the Tosfos, where you see the word Potter over there.
Right, on the right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. It says, Potter Mekriyashma. So he says, he wants to know, this is quotation, okay? Potter Mekriyashma. Says, in the Yerushalmi Gemara, the Porish Talmud, there's a different explanation. Why is the Potter from Kriyashma? He says, Omer Rabun, Ksiv, it is written, Laman Tizkor, right? You should remember, as Yom Tzeiskom Eretz Yisrael, right? Remember them, call Yimei Chayecha, right? Should remember them all the days of your life. So, Yomim Shato Isik Bachayim, Velo Yomim Shato Mesik Bemeisim. So, the Rishalmi says, those days when you're dealing with human, with living beings, and in that particular case, you have to recite Krishna. But when you are dealing with Mesim, with the dead, then in that case you are excused from it until you can fulfill your obligation over there. So then he says, Hoki Gartin, this is what we should read then. Potemikriyashma minat bilo aminat bilo. Alright. Now, let's continue. I'm going to skip the next Tosfos and go down to Eilu ve'eilu. Okay? Next one. It says Eilu ve'eilu betur minat bilo. Okay? Whether they're in front of the mito or behind the mito, right? We said that they are excused from Shmonesra, of all the Kriyashma or Bitfilin, but with Krishma and in putting on Filin, Shehem is a rise to a Chayovim. They are obligated to fulfill those. Vereisha de Ka'oma, Mishemoise, Mutro de Ponov, the Potom in Kriyashma, Minat Filin, etc. And the first part of the Mishnah where it says that the person who has lost one of his immediate members of the family, right, and it's still unburied, so he's potter from Krishma and Mitfilin. So all the more so, the potter may not feel it, then all the more reason that he is excused from saying Shmonesra. In other words, what Tosfos is pointing out over here is that if they are excused from the biblical things,
then they certainly are
excused from the rabbinic thing. Ela loy boile misdem bereisha, ela echoluk, but he says the Mishnah is stressing over here rather the difference between those who are carrying the bier as compared to the person who has lost, and the dead still is unburied. That first we have to deal with one law and then we have to deal with a second law. So we continue now with the Gemara. The Gemara says, "Buto lefonov hein v'sheinu buto lefonov lo." Now, in order to understand the Gemara over here, we have to understand that whereas we have understood "mishemaisem buto lefonov," we've taken it in a somewhat figurative sense, and we'll get back to that. But nevertheless, there are those who take it very, very literally, and this is what the Gemara says: "What are you taking a literal meaning that?" If the dead is lying there right in front of you, right in your presence, right, then you're excused. But if it's not in your presence, let's say you're in a different room, you understand? Then in that case, you are, low. In other words, you're not excused. In other words, you have to re-say it. Raminhu. So we have a Gemara which objects, which has a contrary point of view. It says as follows. If a person has lost, you know, someone near and dear, and that person is there right in the room with him, that is, the dead body is there, so oichel b'vayis acher, then in that case he has to eat in another room. Now over here the word bias has to be understood as cheder. This is how Rashi understands it, and the Gemara substantiates that in several other places. Okay, so it means that he has to eat in a different room, not in the room where the dead person is. Okay, the yimein lo bias acher. And what if he has only a one room house? Then in that particular case, ochel beveis chaveiro, that he should eat at the home of his friend. The imlein lo beis chaveiro. And what happens if he doesn't have a friend at whose house he could eat? Then in that case, oisa mechitzo, then he has to set up some sort of a partition between the dead body and where he is, we ochel, and he eats. The imlein lo dover la seis mechitzo, and let's say he has doesn't even have something with which to make a mechitzo, then marzi ponov, then in that case he turns his back, the oichel, and he eats his food. Okay, so how are we taking then misha meisam muta leponov? We're taking it now very literally, right? That the dead body is actually lying over there, and so what should he do? All right, so as far as eating is concerned, we see he should not eat
in the same
in
room.
The presence in the same room or in the presence of the dead, unless he has no other alternative, whatever. Okay. Next. Now, he's permitted to eat, but there are restrictions upon what happens at this point. First of all, it says, V'yeno meisev. Now, meisev, if you remember, this is what we have, you know, when we say, at the Seder, kolonu mesuvin. What do we mean by kolonu mesuvin? Yeah, we all recline, right? That this was, as we said, the way years ago that people showed that they were aristocrats, that they were the equal of the lords and the princes and the nobles, etc., etc., that they would recline on the couch and eat, you know, that way. So that this is Haseba. We do it, you know, symbolically when we recline on the pillow at the time that we drink either a cup of wine or we eat the matzah, right? Or we eat the sandwich and the malfikamen, you know. In other words, whatever is involved with the wine or with the matzah, those mitzvahs, so those we are misuvin. But when it's just plain moror by itself, then in that case we don't. All right. So anyway, eino meisev, you're not allowed to recline, which would be a sign of, you know, luxury, whatever it may be. You cannot show luxury at the time when you're eating and the dead is still unburied. Okay. V'yeinu eichel basar, v'yeinu shosiyayin. These are two other restrictions. The onein is not permitted, right, to either eat meat or to drink wine. Why not? The answer is very simple. Because wine and meat are considered the ingredients of simcha. There's a Gemara which says, you know, regarding to Simchas Yom Tov, right? It's a mitzvah. We know that v'samachta b'chagecha, that you are to be happy, you are to rejoice in your festivals, right? Well, yisach sameach. So the Gemara wants to know, how do you rejoice on Yom Tov? So the classic answer is b'basa v'yayin. In other words, by eating meat and drinking wine, this is how you show simcha. Okay. So therefore, the onay, dead, still has not been buried, therefore he's not allowed to eat meat or to drink wine. Alright, so here we have already three restrictions. The Yenim of Horech, another restriction, that he does not make the bracha. Now, not sure which bracha we're talking about, but talking about the bracha Hamotzi, exactly. Okay? He's not allowed to recite the Hamotzi before the meal. The Yenim is Zame, nor does he recite the Pirkas Hamozen after the meal. The ain mevorachim olav, nor can he be yaseh with somebody else making the bracha for him, making the bracha to hamotzi. Okay, he cannot be yaseh with that. In other words, he has to eat as the sebi if he just has to eat by himself. The ain mezamin olav, nor can they count him to a mezuman, since he himself cannot bench, so he cannot be counted to a mezuman even for benching. And he is potter, you know, from reciting the Krishna and from the Shmona Esrei and Hatilim from wearing tefillin. They call mitzvahs amurus batorim from all those mitzvahs that are mentioned in the Torah. Or with Shabbos, and here we come to the question, you know, that you asked about Shabbos. On Shabbos, may save, in that case he is permitted to recline when he eats. V'yochel basar v'sheis yayin, he's permitted to eat meat, he's permitted to drink wine. Umevorech, and he makes the hamotzi, umezamin, and recites the birkas hamazon. Umevorechim olov, and if somebody else wants to be motzi him by reciting the hamotzi, you know, this is a common thing, that particularly when you eat as a group eating together, okay? Of course, everybody could either recite the hamotzi for himself, which is what most people probably do, but if it's like a festive occasion, you have someone who makes the hamotzi for the entire eilim, that's considered a very kosher thing, okay? So in that case, on Shabbos, if he's eating with a group, then in that particular case, he is permitted to be yotze with the bracha that they make for hamotzi. Just as he can make the bracha himself, so he can also be yotze with the bracha that others make for him. Okay? Umezamnim alav, he can also be counted to the mezumim. And this, remember, is v'chayim b'chol ha-mitzvahs ha-mitzvahs b'torah. He is obligated to perform all mitzvahs that are mentioned in the Torah. Now remember, here we're talking about the person who is an onen, right? But all these rules, for the onen are suspended if it is Shabbos. Naturally, when Shabbos is over, then he reverts again to the state of being an onen. Okay. So we've learned something important about the difference between Shabbos and others. Now there's one more difference of opinion, as we'll see. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel over Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says that the Torah is chayav be'el and is chayav be'chulon. Inasmuch as he's obligated to do this, and obviously he's obligated to observe all the mitzvahs. So now the question is, what do we mean by all mitzvahs? So Rabbi Yochanan said, my benayu, what is the difference between the anonymous author of this Baraisa, which we quoted, which says, you know, that he observes all the mitzvahs, and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's added statement that inasmuch as he is obligated to do everything else, so he's obligated to do everything. What is the everything, in other words? So he answers, Ikabinayhu, he says, Tashmish Hamita Ikabinayhu. The question of having relations with his wife. This is the thing that where there is a difference of opinion. In other words, according to the first statement, we would say that this is the one area which the onen must refrain from. You know, let's say he lost a brother or a sister, he lost a parent, okay?
He's not to have.
All right, well, now we know. I mean, one of the things that you observe during Shiva is that you're not allowed to have marital intercourse, okay? But according to this opinion, right, even if it is Shabbos, he's not allowed to have marital intercourse. Of course, that's a question, incidentally, about the Avelis itself. I'll come back to that in a second, okay? On the other hand, the other opinion, which says this chayev bekulon, that he, you know, he has to observe every single thing, then in that case, according to this opinion, he must have marital intercourse. Why must he have marital intercourse? Because it's considered a mitzvah that on Friday night you have marital intercourse. I don't know how many people observe it. Could be that some people observe this mitzvah even if they don't observe other mitzvahs. I don't know. On the other hand, I suppose sometimes you slip up on this mitzvah too. Especially
isn't all this
or something like
it's
that.
It's a mitzvah
right.
on Friday night.
Right. But the point is, as I said, an onen then should not do it according to one opinion. By the way, this is the prevailing opinion because there's even another
reason.
Yes. And that is, okay, the laws for an onen, you know, this would represent perhaps, let's say, the most severe point of Avelis, okay? The very first one. The second stage, as we said, is what? That, you know, after the burials take place, then you sit Shiva. All right. But we have a law which says that on Shabbos, while you're sitting Shiva, you do not observe Adelis Befarhesia, which means a public demonstration of Adelis in mourning, but you do have to observe Adelis Shevetzina. You have to observe those things that you do privately in your own home. Okay? So, what is, of course, the most private of all mitzvahs?
Is the sex.
Is sex, right. Have, and, of course, you know, to have relations with your wife. Okay? So, that being the case, therefore, even during the Shiva, the Ovel on Friday night is not permitted to have relations with his wife. He has to observe that, you know, throughout the 7 days of Shiva.
Once
Shiva is over,
it doesn't carry over to the Shloshim.
No. Of course, remember that Shloshim, which means 30 days, actually it starts from the same moment that Shiva begins.
Right.
In other words, it begins with the time that the burial has taken place. That's when you start to count, okay? And the same rule that I said before about Mixas Hayom Kekul Hayom, you know, that part of the day is considered as if you observe the whole day, this would apply both to the beginning and also to the end of Shloshim as it does to the beginning and the end of Shiva. Okay. So that's the major area of the Parhesia. But, for example, if people come to visit them on Shabbos, it's a question whether there should be Nichum Avelim on Shabbos or not. But, you know, there are those who say, yes, why not, you know, come and comfort the mourners even on Shabbos, even though, you know, you might consider it like a Befar Hesya.
Yeah, but taking away from the joy of Shabbos.
Yeah, but, I mean, there are those who feel that you should nevertheless go and, you know, express your consolation over there. So, the mourners do not, sit with slippers on the low and so on, because that would be public demonstration. They have to sit on a regular chair, wear regular shoes on Shabbos and things like that. You see, so that's why I say the most private area, which is, that the Ovel is prohibited from serving this, of course, is marital relations. All right. So, getting back to our text right now, Omar Rapapa. Rapapa said, "Let's see, like, all right." No, I skipped one line. All right. Mihas, nevertheless, what? Potem kriya shma, not film, and call mitzvah amulis batayor. Nevertheless, we see that the person who is mutal afonov, right, where the mace is there, he is excused from krishma, from davening shmanesra, from wearing tefillin, from all other affirmative mitzvahs that are mentioned in the Torah, as long as what? As long as the burial of the dead has not yet taken place. But how have we been understanding it until this point? We have understood it first in a very literal sense, because the Baraisa spoke about what? That if the dead is there, right in the same room where you are, then you're not allowed to eat over there. And, you know, we went through the whole business. What should you do in that particular case? Now what we are saying is that Mishemeso Mutalufonov, this doesn't mean necessarily literally. What it means is that as long as the burial has not yet taken place, during that time, the onan is excused from all this. So that this, of course, is, you know, the interpretation that I've been using until now, but as we see, the rabbis had to first thrash it out themselves. Do they mean it literally, or do they mean it, you know, in a more figurative sense? And of course, the answer is in a more figurative sense, except for, you know, the literal application. That goes without saying. But in a figurative sense, as long as the burial has not yet taken place, then you are excused from all these things, except, of course, if Shabbos intervenes, as we said, and you have to observe them. Okay. Omer Rapapa. So Rapapa says, Tirgumar Asir Pono V'Eichel. He says that the Baraisa was only referring specifically to the person who is told that if he has no other alternative, then he has to what? Turn his face away from the dead and eat. But that's the only literal application that concerns us. Otherwise, we are more, you know, interested in the other interpretation. Yeah, as Rav Ashi says, he says, Omar Kevin Shemutal Olov Likovral Kemutal Fanodon. This is the basic statement over here. He's saying that inasmuch as he has, as he's lying there in front of him in order to bury him, in other words, not literally, but the obligation to bury him is there, then it's as if the body were there actually in the same place with him, as long as the burial has not yet taken place. So that's it. Shneemar, and how do we know this? He says, we learned this from the first case of Avelus mentioned in the Torah, which is, of course, about Abraham. It's written, Shneemar, Vayokam Abraham, the Alpanei. So, it is written that Abraham arose from, literally, the presence of his dead. Naturally, she had passed away. Where was he living at the time?
You mean Sarah passed away?
But Sarah passed away, yeah. No, she didn't pass away in Hebron. Where was he living? He was living in Beersheba.
Beersheba.
He was living in Beersheba, okay? Yet, where does he go for burial? It's written, you know, in the next quotation over there that Abraham says to the people, you know, the Neches and so on, from Achiti, he says to him, yeah. In Emar it's written, you know, afterwards, let me bury my dead from before me, literally from my presence. All right. So, if Sarah was in Beersheba and he was in Hebron trying to buy a cemetery plot, so obviously she wasn't there as yet. She died. Okay. Let's review orally what is written over there, all right? Right. Then it's written, Vatoma Sora Bekiryas Arba Hi Hebron, right? That she, there it's written that she passed away in Kiryas Arba in Hebron. Okay. All right. But at any rate, so she didn't die in Beersheba, she died in Hebron. The Torah says so. But nevertheless, what do we find? The more important thing is not where she died, but the more important thing is that she hasn't been buried as yet. And what is he saying?
He's saying to the Neches,
he says, look, let me bury my dead mil fonai, right, from before my presence, even though she was someplace else at the moment, undoubtedly, all right? Maybe she was at Asher's, I don't know. But at any rate, she wasn't there while he was, you know, digging for the real estate, you know, see.
And he wanted to give it for nothing, he didn't want to take it.
Right. But if you remember before, I mean, it's written already, you know, by Yoram Lispo the Sarah, Abraham came in order to mourn for Sarah, and by Lispo, we mean particularly to give a funeral eulogy for her, but of Kaisa, and also to weep for her, and so on, so that all these things were taking place. And here she has not yet been buried. So that therefore, from this, we learn already that what? That Muto Lefono, or Muto Lefonai, whatever you want to say, in other words, the idea of milfonai, or milfonov, or miponov, whatever it is, that is the same as mutol lefonov. The burial has not yet taken place, and therefore it's as if the mess is still lying there literally in his presence until the burial takes place. All right, we continue right now.
Come over home, yeah. We'll see you.
No, all right, so. Right, as long as he still has to bury, then kemuta lefono dummy, okay, dummy mesa, okay. No, excuse me, kemuta lefono dummy. Right, so as if you know, the dead were lying there in front of him. So. As long as the burial has not taken place, then this is what we're talking about. Now, Gemara now asks the following question. It says, Meso in Avol Neshamar Lo. All right, we have said that the person who has lost his close relative is excused from saying Krishman's son, right? How about the person who has to watch the dead body until the burial takes place? We know it is a mitzvah to have a meshamer. It's a mitzvah to have someone watch over the dead from the time, you know, that the death has taken place, when the tzar has taken place, until such time that they're ready for the funeral. Okay? So, what about the meshamer? Are we to assume that he is not excused? The Hor Tanya, didn't we learn the Baraisa, which says, Hameshamer es hameis, that if a person is guarding the body of the dead, afal pi shein meumei, so even though it's not his own personal loss, potter mekri ashman nefil nefil and mekol mitzvah samuz patora.
He's also potter.
Yeah, he's also potter then from Krishna, from davening Shmonesra, from putting on tefillin, and from all the mitzvahs that are prescribed in the Torah.
Because he's obligated to wash the mace.
Right. And Mishamro, the person who is washing the dead, afal pi sheinu mace. So even though it's not his personal dead, and meso, his personal dead, afal pi sheinu mishamro, even if he's not watching over the body. In other words, it makes no difference whether we're talking about the person who has lost, you know, who has suffered the loss, or whether it's the person who is guarding. In either case, they are excused from all these things as long as they are occupied with what they're doing. He being occupied in arranging for the burial, and the other one making sure that the body will not come to any physical harm during the time, you know, before burial. Okay? Now, Meso and Mishamro in, how about the person, you know, who either it's his own personal loss or the person who's guarding him? Yes. In other words, we just said that, you know, either of them are excused. Avol mahalek v'veis hakvoros lo. But shall we say if a person is walking in the cemetery, he is not excused? In other words, then what should he do? If a person is in the cemetery, presumably he should daven. He should put on tefillin. No. V'ho tanya, we've learned. The Sefer Torah is wrong. A person should not go to a cemetery wearing tefillin on his head or carrying a Sefer Torah in his arm. The Koreh, and reading Krishna, money. The Yim Osa Kain, and if he does so, Oyve Mishum Loeg Lovosh Hereif Osehu. And in that case, he violates the statement which says in Mishlei, in the book of Proverbs, which says, Loeg Larosh, if a person mocks someone who is poor, then Cheref Hosev, says, if he shows contempt for his maker. In other words, if you make fun, or if you mock a poor person, you are insulting the Rabbeinu Shel Olam who made the poor person. Now here they're taking the word rosh, poor, not in its literal sense, but they're taking in the sense of a person who is dead and who, you know, who nebuch, I mean, is in no position, you know, to do anything, you know, to talk back or whatever it may be, right? So that therefore we see from this that you do not go into a Beis Elam wearing, you know, tefillin, or carrying a Sefer Torah. You don't daven in the Beis Salem. These are things that you don't do because it's as if you were mocking the dead. I would add that there's another Gemara which says the same thing about, you know, wearing a talis and having the tzitzis drag on the ground. It's as though you're saying to the mess, you see, you can't do these mitzvahs that I can do, or something like that. And therefore, if you're mocking the dead, and Sherev Oseu, you are showing your contempt for the Rabbeinu Shel Olam who made all of us, whether we are alive or whether we have passed away. So they say, Hosam toicha ba amos hu de osam. Chutz liyaba amos chaya. So they say, well, as far as davening is concerned, or even going, I mean, you shouldn't do this, but there is a distinction between, are you within 4 cubits, which would mean roughly about 6 feet of the caver, or are you more than 6 feet away from the caver? Question has come up, I mean, been asked several times, you know, about, for example, a coin. Can a coin go to the cemetery? Better that the coin does not go in the cemetery. Okay? It's better.
Unless it's part of it.
No. For the burial, he's permitted, because that overrides it. I mean, the coin has to be metame for his father, his mother, etc., his wife, you son, daughter, brother, sister, okay? Has to be the tummy. So the Torah says, you know, as far as the sister is concerned, the sister is the one who is not married. But nevertheless, we go a step further and say, even for a married sister, you observe, you know, Shiva, you can tell me the mace, and so on and so forth, okay? Now, so that therefore, Cohen has to participate, you know, in the burial of his close relative, okay? But an ordinary Cohen afterwards, can a Cohen, for example, go to visit the cemetery, let's say, in Chodesh Elul?
No.
Okay? Should not go. Should not go. However, there are those who say, based upon this statement that we just learned, that if he could stand, let's say, in a roadway, which is more than 6 feet from the nearest grave, then in that particular case, he would be permitted to go. Now, what they did at Kadima, for example, is not to go in the roadway, but they have a fence along the side so that if the Kohen wants to be close enough to the fence, he could do it. And some of our Kohanim families happen to be buried on that side close to the fence, so that by standing outside on the field, they could still hear what's going on and, you know, sort of participate, you know, if not physically within the Arba Amos, but nevertheless at least in close enough proximity so that they can feel that they are taking part in the, whether it's the burial or even such thing as an unveiling or something like that.
Mm-hmm. What about visitation?
That's what I'm saying. No, no, I just said that it should not be done. But I said there is a minority opinion that says that if you go into a base like Boris, if you're okay, don't go into the cemetery, period. Okay, let me just finish over here and then we'll say the Rabbanan Kaddish. Okay. So he says, all right, let me review again. Asim toch haba amos hu de osir, right. If you're within 4 amos, in other words, approximately 6 feet from a mess, from a caver, then in that case it is prohibited. But chutzli arba amos, if you are beyond, further than the 6 feet or so, make it further than 7 feet if you wish, because people are not 100% sure exactly how much is an amma. Some say it's 18 inches, some say it's 20, 24 inches, you know, there are different opinions. So whatever the amma is, you take the maximum and multiply it by 4 in order to say how far you should stay away from there, okay? The amma mar, as one of the sages said, meis, tofes, dalet, amos, okay? Likriyashma. So, the mace, he says, it's as though he possesses, he owns the Dalet Amos. This is as far as Krishna is concerned. So he says, Hocho chutz the Dalet Amos, dami poter. But we're saying, in reality, that even if it's beyond that, nevertheless, he should also be poter from reciting it, because he has no business being in the cemetery, period. Don't come with tefillin, don't come with the Sefer Torah, don't daven on the cemetery itself, and so on. I mean, this is not the place in order to carry out these things. Okay. The fact that Beis Tofes Dalet Amos, this in itself is also an important rule as far as, you know, what do we consider the personal possession of the mess? The answer is the 4 cubits that he occupies. In other words, the burial plot itself. Okay. Rabbi Hanani ben Akash Yomer Rosh HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lezakos Yisrael Ufichol Chiyo Blachem Teo Mitzvah Shenemar Adonoi Chofei Shemar Yisrael Yadil Kevo Yadil. Very good. Okay. Alright, we'll start from where we left off last week. If you remember, what we were dealing with was, among other things, what is a ovel excused from reciting Krishna, davening, and so on. And we said this is when he is an onain. In other words, he is dead, still has not yet been buried, and therefore his major occupation at this point should be to take care of the dead. And we also said that If it happens on Shabbos, then on Shabbos he's permitted to do those things that he is prohibited if it were a weekday. Because obviously there's not going to be any kibura on Shabbos. So while if it happened during the week and, you know, he became an onin at that time, then he's not allowed to eat meat, he's not allowed to drink wine, and he's excused from all the davening. He can't bench, he can't bake birkas hamazon, he can't bench, he can't be counted to mezumim. He said all these things apply to the yoni. But if it happens to be on Shabbos, then in that particular case, so we said that on Shabbos he does do all these things. And the only question is, as we saw, that there was a difference of opinion between the Chachamim and between Rabbi Shimon and Gamliel as to whether he's permitted to have intercourse with his wife on Friday night, because after all he is an onan. But if he can perform all the mitzvahs in the Torah, including all these things that we mentioned, such as davening, saying Krishna, etc., etc., then in that case he should also be permitted to have relations with his wife. But the other opinion is that it's not proper to do it as long as the dead body hasn't been right. Well, you can never tell. The idea, I mean, why did they mention Friday night? Because it's considered a mitzvah on Friday night. That's the basic reason.
I understand.
Right. But apart from that, you know, then of course there's no question. But generally our feeling is that you don't do it. It's not right. And as I pointed out last week, even once he becomes an ovel, and he's then subject, you know, to all the restrictions that an ovel has. For example, he has to sit shiva, and he has to take off his shoes and things like that, and so on. And the question is, what happens to our avelus on Shabbos? And we said that the general rule is that you do not observe avelus b'parhesia, in other words, public avelus on Shabbos, but you do observe avelus b'tzino, private. Private avelus you do observe during the week of Shiva. Okay? So, question is then, I mean, then what specifically would be prohibited under this category? Because obviously, if people are coming to visit, he is permitted to put on shoes, he's permitted to go to shul, to daven, good evening, good evening.
This is for Shabbos only you're talking about.
I'm talking about Shabbos, right. Okay. Shabbos, he's permitted to go to shul, you know, he doesn't have to sit Shiva at home. Okay?
But once he gets home, he should be an avail.
Yeah, but he doesn't put on his, he doesn't take off his shoes, for example.
On Shabbos, even at home.
Right. So why? How about people may come to visit.
That's
like a public manifestation.
While nobody's there.
Huh?
While nobody's there.
But even while nobody is there, I mean, we don't force him. But what is the avail shebitzina that he must observe? That is, you know, he's not allowed to have relations with his wife.
That's it.
On Shabbos, right. This is
prohibited. He doesn't sit on a bench either on Shabbos at home alone?
Right, he does not sit on a bench either. Okay? So that on Shabbos, avelus would be suspended because, after all, people may come to visit. I'm not saying that they're going to come. In general, the idea is, you know, don't knock yourself out to go visit the novel, but still, it's not prohibited from visiting a novel on Shabbos. Right. So if you're going to visit a novel on Shabbos, then he is not allowed to make a public manifestation of his avelus on Shabbos. So this is what I'm saying, that avelus, you know, betzino he observes, but not avelus b'fahesia, and these different things would be considered avelus b'fahesia. Okay? So question, for example, should an ovel accept an aliyah on Shabbos while he's sitting shiva? We say no, don't offer him an aliyah on Shabbos. It's not considered proper. Even though, again, you know, why isn't it proper? It's not proper because of the fact that Kriya Satorah, learning Torah, right? Learning Torah is one of the things that is prohibited to an ovel during the week of Shiva. In other words, is the Torah, when we sit down and we learn Torah, it brings us so much joy. At least I hope it does. So that...
we wouldn't be here otherwise.
Right. I mean, we all know that when we sit and you have it, it's like a schmuck or something that you learn, whether it's Gemara or whether you learn Novi or whatever it may be, you know. And you have a feeling of joy, of Yiddish and Achas, I mean, when you learn it. So, this is Simcha, you see. And therefore, since the Ovel is not permitted to have Simcha, so he's not allowed to study Torah. I do have to tell you that there is an exception to that, and of course, The exception is that he is permitted to study those things that we associate with Avelis. For example, in the Tanakh we have the book of Iyov, the story of Job. And most of the world, you know, most of the book of Job is really a lamentation, you know, about the fate of a man who's, he suffers, he doesn't know why he is suffering, people try to comfort him, and in the final analysis the feeling is that the comfort that they offered him is really, it's no great comfort at all, you see. So this we're permitted to read. In the book of Yirmiyahu, for example, you have nevuahs that deal with Chorban, and you have others which deal with Nechon. Okay? You know, I mean, consolation as compared to nevuahs which predict the destruction of Yerushalayim. Okay? So, the Ovel would be permitted, for example, to read those portions of Yirmiyahu which speak about destruction. He would be prohibited from reading about Nechon, because one brings sorrow and the other one, of course, brings joy. So the same rule that applies to the Ovel sitting Shiva also applies to us, who are all of us Avelim when it comes to Tisha B'Av. That on Tisha B'Av we're not allowed to study Torah except those portions, you know, those aspects of Torah that speak of sorrow, of Chorban, and things like that. Those that I mentioned, plus, for example, there are a couple of different chapters in the Gemara, like, and there's one Gemara in Gittin, where part of that chapter deals specifically with the stories about the Chorban Habayis, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. It begins with a very famous section about, because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, Yerushalayim was destroyed, and so on. And then it goes into other stories dealing not only with the destruction of Yerushalayim, but the destruction of Beitar, where again a great slaughter, a great massacre of Jews took place, and so on. So that we are permitted, you know, to study that. Or the fourth chapter of Moed Katan, which normally deals with the rules of Chol HaMoed, but since Chol HaMoed, also the question arises of what happens if somebody passes away on Chol HaMoed, on Yom Tov, and so what do you do then as far as Avelis is concerned? So therefore we are permitted to study those selections of Eilam Megalkin, which is the name of that chapter, which are pertinent to the laws of Avelis. So those are the things we can study being an Avel, but otherwise we are not.
For
David?
What period of time is the Avel prohibited from studying the Torah?
Yeah, the answer is only during the period of Shiva. Okay. Only during the period of Shiva, right. Not talking about Shloshim. Then it's a mitzvah to study. As a matter of fact, many people have the minhag that, you know, once they get up from Avelis, then they start in to try to learn Mishnah every day. If you can't do a whole chapter of Mishnah, do a little bit of a Mishnah, something like that, you know, in memory of the Niftar. And there's an interesting reason why there's a connection between Mishnah and between Avelis. I don't know if you can figure it out. Is there anything in the word Mishnah itself which might suggest an answer?
Shana?
Huh?
Shana?
Shana Adira?
Not quite.
Shana?
Huh?
Shana?
See, that's because you're looking only at part of the word, not looking at the whole word.
Shanui for change.
No, okay.
We're quite
don't want to keep you on pet dogs. The answer is that the letters Mem, Shin, Nun, Hey, yeah, turn it around differently, and what do you have? You have the word Neshama. So oh, that is the connection between them. And as a matter of fact, there is one chapter in Mishnah, in Caleb, which is a favorite Mishnah to study. If you take a look at certain Siddurim, such as the Nusach Ari Siddur that Lubavitch has put out, except that there it's in Hebrew, but you know, you won't find it in English. But if you look in the Odd Scroll Siddur, there they have it both in the Hebrew and in the English, and you see. And the end of that chapter has Mishnayos, where the first letter of the Mishnah begins with a Nun, the next one begins with a Shin, the next one with a Mem, and the last one with a Hey. So again, we see a reference to the idea of Neshama, so that therefore the tradition has arisen that the study Mishnah is a worthy act that we perform, not only in memory of the deceased, but also it helps, so to speak, in the ilui haneshama. In other words, the raising of the neshama from the lower depths, you know, to the highest heights that you can possibly have. So these are things, but when, as I said before, once Shiva is over, so then you begin to study, and many people will study even for a whole year and so on, the study Mishnah, as a zechut, you know, it's for the merit, the debt, and the, as I said, it's also to have an ilui neshama. All right, now let's get back to what text over here. Text is in the middle right now, where it starts with the word gufa. If you see where the long line is in the middle, go up two lines. Mm-hmm. Okay. He gets back now to something that we learned last week, which he wants to discuss a little bit at greater length. This is what gufa means. Gufa means, let's get back again to the guf. In other words, to, so to speak, the body of that which we were talking about before, incidentally. Now we'll discuss it in length, okay? It's a term that we'll find. All right, gufa. Let's get back again to the statement that was said before, hamishamir es hameis, that if somebody watches the dead, apal pi she'eino meis, so even though it is not his own personal dead person, in other words, it's not one of his immediate relatives, right? Potu mikriya shma. Nevertheless, he is excused from kriya shma, uminat filo, uminat filin, umikol nitzvah samur es batoin. Okay? All right. So, if you're busy watching the dead, then in that case, that mitzvah takes precedence, even if it is not someone who is personally related to you. This is what we've learned. Okay? Before we learned that, as a matter of fact, they went into it and they said, even though it's not his dead person and he's watching, he's excused. If it is his dead and he's not watching, he's solicitous. That's the case of the Yonin, as we said. Okay? And if the dead is his personal one and he's watching, he's certainly excused and so on. But the point is that if you're engaged in the mitzvah of watching over the dead, then in that case, you're excused from the other mitzvahs. Okay. Of course, when we watch the dead today, normally what we do is to recite Tehillim.
Question.
Yeah.
When you're sitting and saying Tehillim for a mace,
right,
should you not be in the same room with the mace?
You should be. You should be.
Okay.
Why? We'll see in a second. Why in the final analysis is it necessary to watch the dead? And we'll see. Maybe today it doesn't apply to the same extent. But I'm not going into it. The point is that the custom has arisen, and it's a mark of respect to do so. But we'll see in a moment why they ordained that we should do it. Okay? All right. Now, Gemara continues and says, Hoyu Shnayim, let's say there were two people who were watching. Then in that case, Zeh Nishamir v'zeh Koreh. In other words, this one takes a turn at being the Shomer, right? And then the other one then recites Krishna while his body is being the Shem. And then the Zevishan and Zekorin. And then, you know, they exchange roles, and the second one then watches the dead, and the other one blames Krishna. Benazai Omer, Benazai says, Hoyu Boyan Batspina. What if they were traveling on board a ship? People pass away on a ship too sometimes, okay? So what if they were traveling on board a ship? And you have two people who are watching over the mist. So it says, Mandicho bezovizu, umispalunishtein bezovizacher. So Ben Azai says, then in that case, they can deposit the dead body in one corner, and they recite Krishna in the other corner, another spot. So, of course, this looks like a contradiction. So, my Ben Aihu, what is the difference of opinion between them? Omar Rabino. So Rabina said, the difference of opinion lies in Kocha Shinliat Borem Nikobidat. We are concerned that mice shouldn't come and attack the body. This is the point. In other words, why did the idea of, you know, watching the dead take root? It was in order to make sure that no...
nothing desecrated.
Right, nothing should happen, you know, to the body itself, which would be, of course, a sign of bizoyan, you know, that the body is being treated in a negligent manner, not with the COVID, which is due to a mess. Mess deserves COVID.
Why the plateau for asphyxia?
Pardon me?
Why the
plateau? Oh, so that's what the question is. So why are they potter? So he says, Bar Sovakhaishin, in other words, the first authority who says that one should watch and the other one the Zekore, right? And then they take turns. This is because he says that we are concerned with the fact that even on board a ship, mice might come and defile the dead body. Omar Sovar, and the other one is with the opinion. In other words, Ben Azai, who says that they can both of them go into a corner and read, is because Loi Hashin, he says, we're not concerned, we're not worried that mice are going to come. Apparently, he felt that mice were only a problem on the ground, right? And don't forget, they didn't necessarily have wooden floors and stuff like that, the way he, you know, they built a house that was done very, very simply on the ground, and they simply put up some sort of a structure and so on. So it's easy for a mouse, you know, to crawl underneath and so on. So in order to make sure that the mice do not attack, but once the ship is away from shore, then they're not concerned that about mice. At least Ben-Nazar I wasn't. Of course, I've heard about rats.
Yeah, it could be rats on board.
But maybe Ben-Azai never traveled on board a ship where there were rats. I don't know.
A ship that's large enough to be able to deposit a body in one corner.
Yeah.
Bubonic plague was brought by rats.
Well, you're absolutely right.
From
yeah, yeah. But apparently they didn't think ahead at that time. When Ben-Azai made this statement, he wasn't concerned about bubonic plague. They had plagues. They certainly did. I mean, you can be sure. Look, there's a Nega, Zapega, and Deber, and things like that. I mean, you have all kinds of plagues, pestilence, and so on. Sure, they had plagues. They said that they didn't. But whether they were aware, you know, that there were germs, viruses, and stuff like that, this already is a different story. I mean, this is more, what our own modern research has shown. But nevertheless, I can't say that they didn't have some idea. Obviously, they did have ideas also about contagion, as we see in the case of the Masora. No question about that. I mean, granted, so he's considered impure and so on. But there are other people become impure, you know, they become dummy, let's say that they have a flow of semen or something like that, you understand? Yet they are not forced to stay outside the community, you see. They're not put b'chutz l'machta, you see, as you have in the case of the mitzvah, in the case of the leper. So the Torah has its special reasons, but obviously contagion, I suppose, may have been one of the things that they discovered that it was a reason, but not the reason. The reason is always the fact that the Torah says that this is the way you have to treat them, and so on.
In Matsura, they have that you can remove part of a home or a house where they see.
Yeah, right. I mean, the fact that there's a possibility of leprosy within the house, I mean, this is what you learn towards the end of Parsha Mitzora, right? Or at the end of Parsha Tazria, where they have about the beged, it's possible for a beged to have an area of leprosy within it and things like that. So, I mean, these are things that obviously they were familiar with. Just as we find, incidentally, there are many, many pages in the Gemara which deal with all kinds of remedies for different ailments. If you have an earache, if you have this, you have a pain here, a pain there, and things like that, you know, and they give suggested remedies or things to do, you know, in order to help alleviate the pain or to alleviate the sickness. So, some of it may be perhaps today, from our point of view, maybe it's a little bit antiquated or something like that, but nevertheless, there was a germ of science in these different things that they prescribed. So if you want to sometimes read something that they already have, for example, in Gemara Avodah Zarah, they have several pages devoted to something like that, where you have descriptions of different ailments and what are some of the suggested remedies. We mustn't forget, you know, that many of the rabbis were themselves physicians also, you see, so that they had a practical knowledge of problems, and they learned how to deal with many things. I won't say that their medical knowledge is the equal of today's medical school graduate, but nevertheless, they had a good practical background in the medicine of their time. No question about that. Okay. Anyway, we continue with the Gemara. Tana Rabba, another Baraisa. It says, Hamoli chatzomes b'mokem namokem ha'reza l'yitneim b'diskiya v'yitneim al-gabaya chamor v'yirkav alehem b'nei she'noheg b'hem mikhan minhag b'zoyot. All right. Somebody carries bones from one place to another place. All right. This we have to understand, this carrying of bones. Number one, if you would find bones on the ground, naturally it's a mitzvah to do what? Bring them to bury them. No question about that. Okay? That's number one. But secondly, it seems that some of them were accustomed to first bury the, to put the bones inside a sarcophagus, let it stay there for a while until the flesh became consumed as time went on, and then they would take the bones and bury it in the ground. So, in any rate, a person gathers up the bones of a mess, okay? And he has to bring it from one place to wherever it is, you know, that he can bury those bones, okay? Let's say it were, for example, the bones of his father who had passed away in City A, and he wants to bury them in his hometown in City B, okay?
Is that for exhuming him?
Yes.
Is that for
right. So, in that particular case, it says that if you're carrying bones from one place to another, then don't put them into a great big bag, which is a diskaya. It's a great big leather bag, which could fit, of course, over the donkey, okay, that he was using to carry the bones. So don't put them in a great big bag. Put them on top of the donkey, and then ride on top of them. Don't ride. This is the important. Right. Don't ride on them. Okay.
Don't ride on them.
Right. In other words, it's some kind like a saddle sack, so to speak. Okay.
Like a body bag they have today.
Yeah, I suppose. But I'm talking right. If you wish, to make that comparison, good. But this is like a saddle bag that you know you put on top of the animal when you're traveling. All right. So, do not put them in the saddle bag. Put them on top of the donkey and then sit down on top of them and ride on them. This is what you're not allowed to do. Okay? Carrying them is permitted. It's not to ride on top of them. Why? Because it's minhag b'zoyin. It's as if you are treating them in an extremely disrespectful manner. You know, b'zoyin means you're insulting them. You're being disrespectful to them. So this is what you're not allowed to do. V'yim hoya misyorim pnei nochrim u'mipnei listim. However, what if you are afraid of goyim? Nochrim means goyim over here, okay? Or you're afraid of highway robbers, then mutar. They're permitted to do so. Now, obviously, what does it mean to be afraid of them? I don't know whether he means so much the fact that afraid that maybe they'll see a bag and they think, you know, that maybe it contains all kinds of riches in there, you're carrying your personal belongings. Possibly that, or it may simply be that maybe you need the animal in order to give you a swifter locomotion, you know, to get away from bandits if they're following you. Okay? But at any rate, if you're afraid that you're going to be attacked by goyim or by listim, by bandits, then in that case, it is permitted. It's permitted, in other words, to sit on top of the saddlebag containing the bones, on top of the animal, and go on your way. And just as they made this general rule concerning bones, so likewise they say the same thing concerning a Sefer Torah. In other words, if you're carrying a Sefer Torah from one place to another, you're permitted to put it into a saddlebag, but you're not allowed to sit on top of it because it is derech b'zoyer for the Sefer Torah. So they say, "Ahaya, what are you referring this to?" He says, "Ilema reisho." If you're talking about the first part of the statement that was made, namely that you're not allowed to do it as a general rule, so pshita, of course, migora Sefer Torah miatzomos is a Sefer Torah to be considered in a lower rank than the bones. obviously, if you're showing bezoyin to the bones by writing on them, right? So you're certainly showing bezoyin, showing contempt for the Sefer Torah by writing on top of it. Ela Sefer, but the question is, what about the last sentence, which says that if you're afraid of robbers, or if you're afraid of goyim who are going to attack you, then in that case, is it permitted? So the answer is yes. According to this opinion, then it would be permitted. Okay. The Gemara continues, and it says, Omar Rachba. Here's a statement that they quote the name of Rachba. It says, Omar Rabbi Huda, who quotes in the name of Rabbi Huda, and he says, Kol Horoya Hameis. If somebody sees a dead person, a dead body, the Yenu Melaveyu, and he does not accompany him, then Oivel Mishum Loeg Larosh, Cheref Oseil. Then in that case, he is guilty of violating this verse that we've already quoted before, namely, that he who mocks the poor shows contempt for his maker. In other words, if you make fun of somebody who is poor, you're showing your contempt for the Rabbeinu Shel Olam as well, because Rabbeinu Shel Olam made all of us, including the poor people. The Yim Hil Vohu, but what happens if he escorted him? So Masa Choro, then what is his reward? Now incidentally, I want to call your attention to the fact Hil Vohu. You know, the verb itself is lamed vav hey, that's the root, okay? In the kal, which would be lova or love and so on and so forth, the word means to borrow. Okay? In the pl, which would be the lavos, it means to accompany, to escort. And of course, from this, we have the idea that levaya is a funeral because you escort the dead. You accompany them as they go on their way, you know, as they're taken to the Beis Elam. Okay? But very often in the Gemara, they use the expression not levaya, but they also use the expression halvaya. In other words, the hifil form. Okay? Now, in the hifil, the word then might mean to accompany, but more normally, the meaning of the word lehalvos in the Hebrew is not to accompany, but rather it means to lend to someone. So we have to understand, you see, love is the borrower, and therefore the malve is the person who gives you the loan, okay, from whom you can borrow. He is the creditor, so to speak, okay, he is the lender, okay? So we see over here that he's playing with the words. He says, Vim hil bo, and what if he accompanied him? Ma sechor, what is his reward? So, Ravasi. Ravasi said, all of our Kosovo Emer, concerning him, we have a verse which says, happens to be in the book of Mishlein, the book of Proverbs, says, Malve Hashem Cholnein Dal, which means literally, I'll start with the last two words, Cholnein Dal, a person who has compassion on the poor, is Malve Hashem. He causes the Rabbeinu Shel Olam to become his creditor. He puts the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, in other words, if you wish, he makes the Rabbeinu Shel Olam in debt to him, which is a better way to understand what he's trying to say over here. He makes the Rabbeinu Shel Olam his loiver, makes the Rabbeinu Shel Olam his credit, his borrower. All right, why does he make the Rabbeinu Shel Olam his borrower? The answer is because the Rabbeinu Shel Olam owes him a favor, since he himself has shown compassion to the dal. And as Rashi says, who is more poor than whom? The dead is the poorest person that you could find, you see.
And when we accompany the
okay,
mace,
right,
how far do you have to accompany?
All right, I'll come to that in 1 second. Okay, I just want to finish over here, and yeah.
This is assuming at the time that they're going to the Beis Elam.
Correct. Okay, 1 second. I'll answer your question. All right, I just want to finish over here the last three words that we have before the two dots up there. Mechabdei, but one who honors him, in other words, who honors the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, is one who is what? Choinein Evyon, one who has compassion upon the poor. These two psukim, although they come from the same chapter, but they're not one pasuk, you see. They're two psukim. That's why he quotes them both, in order to show that a person who has compassion, choine, right, chanun, and so on, you understand, upon the poor, is first of all malveh Hashem. He makes the Ribbono Shel Olam in debt to him, so to speak, right? And at the same time, mechabda, you know, a person who honors him, meaning not only who honors the poor, but also who does he honor? He honors the Ribbono Shel Olam by his act of compassion to the poor. Okay? All right, now get back to your answer, to your question, Stan, okay? This is a big problem. If you could actually go all the way to the Beis Elam, fine. That's one. Don't have to tell you that Havayis Hameis is a big mitzvah, okay? But what if you can't? And we know a lot of people can't go all the way to the cemetery. So in that case, the custom is to at least try to go Dalet Amos. In other words, to walk at least 6-7 feet or something as the hearse goes by, so you follow it on foot for, you know, as I say, about 6-7 feet or something like that, and then you are excused from it. You have fulfilled the mitzvah of being Malavet Es Hameis. Okay? So this is what you find. I mean, that if people, you know, instead of rushing immediately to the car in order to get away as fast as possible, if they could stay around at least for a few minutes until the hearse starts out, and then walk following the hearse for a few feet, so you have fulfilled the mitzvah. Now, remember when Ferenc Lotcheva passed away, may she rest in peace, at that time many of us walked as far as the corner of what was in Long Hill Street and so on. And that was already to show even greater respect, you see, to her at the time. Yeah, well, it's at least 3 years, I guess, since she passed away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, well, we have a memorial park for her. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where is
it? Yeah, we put one up. Ferenc Lotcheva, I don't know if you remember her.
Remember the young boy?
Sure. She had a right, Yosef, right. Forrest is her name. Was then, right. Yeah. Right. No, Yosef. Yosef's
right.
Yosef.
Yosef.
Yeah, right. His English name was Forrest, but he didn't like the name Forrest, if you remember.
Was it Forrest?
Forrest, yeah. Well, listen, when she gave birth to him, you know, she was still living in sort of a hippie state or something like that. Afterwards, she became a Balas Tshuva, and she became very, very devout. So, it's tragic that she passed away at an early age, the way she did. But he is under the care of Dani Sayiri in Israel, right? And he's learning in the yeshiva over there. Okay, let us continue. Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Yonason have a shakle with Azle Beveis HaKoros. All right, Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Yonason, what were they doing? They were taking a walk in the cemetery. I don't know why, but I guess it was a place where they could meditate very nicely. All right, so we're taking a walk.
Hope it's during the night.
I hope so too. Have a kashadya techelta the Rabbi Yonason. So you know what was happening? The techelis, you know, the tzitzis of Rabbi Yonason was sort of dragging on the ground. Omalei Rabbi Chiya, so Rabbi Chiya said to him, Dalye, lift it up, Gedeshila Yogma, Lemocha boy Neslin, Vyashom Mecharfin or something. So that the dead should not say, tomorrow they're going to be together with us, and now look how they're insulting us. Why insulting? So we have to understand, the Mason have no mitzvahs to perform, okay? The living are the people who have mitzvahs. So, if you throw the tzitzis on top of the ground where the mitzvah is lying over there, it's as though you're saying, you see, it's loeg l'rosh, it's the same idea that we said before. In other words, you're mocking the poor, right? And thereby, right, insulting the Levedia Shalelem. Because what you're doing is to say, look, I can perform mitzvahs, and you can't, you see. So he said to him, lift up the tzitzis, so that the dead are not going to say, tomorrow these guys are going to be together with us, and here they're insulting us right now. So he said to him, so tell me, are the dead aware of all this business? The hawks here, isn't it written? This happens to be in the book of Kohelis, you know, the book of Ecclesiastes. Kohelis says, the dead don't know anything. not aware of anything. So Amalei, so he said, yeah, im karisav, this is what you have learned. Karisav, of course, means literally you have read, but remember, what is this verb used for? Verb is used for reading in the Torah or reading in the Tanakh, Mikra, okay? So it says, if you read it, lo shadisa, then I want to tell you, you didn't go over it a second time. Im shadisa, if you did go over it a second time, then lo shilashta, then you did not go over it a third time. Im shilashta, if you did go over this pasuk a third time, in other words, if you studied it again and again and again, then in that case, you still don't get what they're telling you. Lo per shudachot. You never heard the explanation of what this pasuk means. It's written, ki achayim yodeim sheyamusu. Those who are alive know that they will die. So who does this part of the verse refer to? It says, elu tzadikim. These are the righteous. Sheve misosa nikru chayim. Who, even in death, they are considered alive. In other words, a person who is a tzaddik, when he dies, we don't talk of him as being dead, but we talk of him as being alive. His spirit lives on, his teachings live on, and he continues to influence our own life. So tzaddikim and misasa nikru chayim. Very famous quotation. Shenemar. Now how do we derive this from a pasuk? So they quote a pasuk. Pasuk is of Yehu ben Yehoyada, that Benayahu, the son of Yehoyada, ben Ishkai, was the son of Ishkai, literally a living man. I'll come back to this in a second. Rafi Olim, he was a man who was filled with all kinds of actions. In other words, he was a very able person. Mikapsa'el, he came from a town called Kapsa'el. I don't know whether the town was called that because it was full of katsonim or not. I'm referring to a story I once read by Mendel Aleichem Sforim, in which he says that, you know, the poor people came from the town called Kapsi Hill because it was all full of katsonim. But this happened to me, actually, after all. What is Kapsi Hill? It means, you know, God has gathered together, you see. But I thought you would enjoy this little play on words by Mendel. Who he called Eshnei Ariel Moab, and he smote the two hearts of Moab. The Hu Yarad, and then he went down the Hikos Ha'ari B'sol Chabor, and he smote the lion in the pit, the Yom HaShelech, on a snowy day. So the Gemara says, Ben Ishchai, you say that he was the son of a living person. Atu kuliyavu b'nei meisingin, who tell me, is everybody else the child of people who are dead? I mean, obviously, all of us had to have a father who was alive, right? So, therefore, this gives rise to the drash, elo ben ish chai. So what then is the meaning of ben ish chai? The answer is that even when he was dead, he was still referred to as being chai, as being alive. Okay, that's fine. Now I have to tell you, we'll take a look for a moment at the Tosfos over here. Very small Tosfos. See one on top over there? Ben Ish Chai, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it says, Atu Kuliyal. All right. Isn't everybody? So he says, "Bisporim meduyakim kisiv chai v'karinim chayav." He says that in those copies of a Tanakh, which are very precise, which are very exact, so there we find that it is written chai, but you know, this is what we call a kisiv. You know what I mean by kisiv? It means that the text is written this way. But the karinun chayel. However, what is the kree? The kree is chayel, which of course would mean then what? Ben ish chayel, which would mean the son of a man of valor. In other words, his father was a very worthy person. You understand? But it says umenaksiv diek. However, our drash over here is derived from the what is written, right? Shalok siv chayil elochai, because it's not written chayil, it is written chay instead. So that this is the reason for the, for the drash. Okay. So we see then that that even in death, the tzaddikim ought to be considered chayim from this verse. Okay. Now, before we continue, there are some very, very interesting Tosfos. Okay. First of all, Tosfos wants to explain to us. Well, let's take a look first at the Rashi and then at Tosfos. Ariel. You see Ariel over there, the fourth line from the bottom of Rashi, Yotes Amid Aleph. Alright, why don't I take all the Rashis over there that we have? Okay? Beginning with Elu Tzadikim. Go up a couple of more lines and see where it says Elu Tzadikim. You see that? Alright, it says Elu Tzadikim. These are the righteous, you know, that they know that they're going to die, right? Chayim Yodim Sheyamusu, it says, right? The living know that they're going to die. So it says, this refers to the Tzadikim. Umay Yodim Sheyamusu. So what does it mean that they know that they're going to die? So Rashi explains, Nosnim el libom yom hamiso. In other words, they take to heart the fact that they're going to die someday. Umoshchim yedehem in huadeva. And what do they do as a result of the realization that death will eventually come? Therefore, they abstain from committing averus. Urishoyim einam yodim umo. But the wicked, they don't know anything. Why? She'osim atzmam doesn't mean that they don't know anything, as you know, but it means she'osim atzmam kenam yodim. They make believe that they don't know anything. Yeah, they know, but they don't pay any attention to it, right? V'chotim, and they sin. Alright, then in reference to Benayahu ben Yehoyada, remember we learned that who he called, right? So what does it mean? He smote the lion and so on and so forth. Okay? Who he called is Shnei Ariel Moab, right? Alright, so he says, what is the meaning over here? So Rashi gives a poetic interpretation. He says, Hishpiles Hashonim Shel Doros. In other words, says Rashi, he shortened the amount of years of the generations, Mishnei Mikdoshim, of the two temples that were going to be built, Shelo Hayoba Hem Kemosa. What it means, says Rashi, is that there was no one like him during the period either of the first Beis HaMikdash or the period of the second Beis HaMikdash. Now, how does he get that we're talking about the Beis HaMikdash? So he says, Ariel Ze Beis HaMikdash. When it says Ariel, Ariel is a reference to the Beis HaMikdash. How do we know that so? Well, we have a pasuk in Yeshayahu which says, Hoy Ariel, Ariel, Kiryas Bano David. Woe unto Ariel, Ariel, the city where David lived. In Yeshayahu. So, from this we know that Ariel is a synonym for the Beis HaMikdash. Others related to the word Harel, which we find in the book of Yechezkel. And there it means the actual altar, the Mizbeach, the name for the Mizbeach in the Beis HaMikdash. So, either case, it refers to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, why does it say Moab? After all, what does the Beis HaMikdash have to do with Moab? You understand? So the answer is, Moab al-Shem Shebinod David, the...